I'm going to call to order the March 5th Ways and Means Committee hearing. Thank you to all of you who are prompt this morning. I think for the first time we actually have a quorum at our start time, so I appreciate that. So I'll have Mr. Smith note the roll. And then I don't think we have any minutes. Oh, I'm sorry. Let's see. Representative Davids, move approval of the minutes from the February 13th meeting. Are there any additions or corrections? Seeing none, all those in favor of approving the minutes as presented, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. The minutes are approved. The next item on our agenda is a presentation by Minnesota Management and Budget of the February forecast that was released last week. To the degree that we're able to hold questions to the end, would appreciate that. And with that, I'll turn it over to the commissioner and let him divide the time as he sees fit.
Thank you. Welcome
to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, for the record, my name is Jim Showalter, Commissioner of Management and Budget. With me, Dr. Tom Stinson, State Economist, State Budget Director Margaret Kelly. Happy to get the chance to just to give you a brief summary of the forecast that I think you're all pretty familiar with at this point. But we will run through some of those slides. We have some additional slides that may pique your interest and are happy to take any questions and just have a chance to drill down a little bit further into some of the economic and spending news that are included in this forecast. The overview here is, I think, quite familiar, that the forecast really reflects very little change from the numbers released in November. About a 1% change to the good due to slight improvements in spending, slight improvements in revenue, all adding up to about a $323 million improvement in our state fiscal situation. That money doesn't hang around longer, though. By current law, it is used to pay off education shifts, to complete the rainy day fund, and that is part of this presentation as well. There has been one subsequent action since the initial release of the forecast. We can get into that later, but I'm going to review the numbers basically as shown at the time of the forecast. With that, let's just take a look at a couple of the slides. The first overview here is really just showing you the magnitude of changes in the forecast. With a roughly $34 billion budget, there's a $93 million change in revenues, a $230 million decrease in projected spending. As you all know, the forecast really takes a look at some of the factors that we base our estimates on during legislative session. That includes changes in the economy, changes in behavior, actuals that we might see people showing up for signing up in programs. And that's really what's driving some of these numbers. That $323 million then is divided into two different places, $5 million to the budget reserve, taking it to $653 million. Which is the statutory authorized number in for that budget reserve. And that basically gets us to about roughly 3% of reserves, including the cash flow account. The school shift buyback, then we start to pay that down. We've still got a lot more to go, but this basically allows us to buy the buyback back to around a 64.3% level. Previously it had been at 60-40. And that $318 million then drives the balance down to zero. This just really takes you into that a little bit further, showing you the exact percentages of the school payment shift, and that it takes about 11% of the shift buyback that we have currently on the books. I think that kind of takes a couple of the key points. We will probably circle back to these a little later on. But really, this is a forecast showing some forecast improvement, and then the state really using current law, and I think wisely so for a number of years, many years, using that to get ourselves back in sound financial footing. We've got a lot more work to do. This is really only a small portion of some of the work we have to do in order to get the state's finances into place I think we all want it to be. But it's certainly a step in the right direction. For us to talk about the economy, I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Stinson, and he will briefly fill you in on some of the economic assumptions and revenue impacts in this forecast.
Thank you, Commissioner. Yeah. Welcome to the committee, Dr. Stinson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The economic story is really
a continuation of the story that Jim just got through telling you, which is that there's just very small change. If you look at the chart that's on the screen and on the handout at the bottom of page 2, you can see that there really aren't very big changes. In fact, the GDP numbers, really the changes aren't noticeable even in them. What is noticeable is that the probability of recession has gone down from November. In November it was 40%, now it's 25%. The next slide shows you what's happened to jobs in Minnesota and the U.S. Jobs are down 2.6% since the recession began in Minnesota, which is not a good situation, but it's a lot better than the situation in the U.S., which is down 4%. Right now, it looks like U.S. jobs will get back to the level that they were at the start of the recession in the third quarter of 2014. For Minnesota, since we're doing a little better, the estimate is the third quarter of 2013. But that's still a long time and a long, a substantial period for very slow growth in employment. The next slide shows what's happened since the bottom in Minnesota's labor market. And you can see that we've gained almost 3% in jobs since the September 2009 low. The U.S. has gained about 2.1%. There aren't big differences. One of the differences you can see is construction. U.S. is down 3.5%. Minnesota is up 3%. This may just be a seasonal adjustment question. We had an awfully warm January, and so that allowed construction activity to proceed at a little bit stronger pace than usual. It also might be a reflection of the fact that construction activity in Minnesota is so low that it really can't fall very much more. The other interesting fact is that professional and business services is up 13.5%. That's probably due to temporary employment agencies. That's where the growth has been. It hasn't been in the technical services, the legal and accounting areas, for example. Moving on, this is one of the issues that we have to face, capital gains. And you can see it's just an incredibly volatile series. We've had two 50% declines in a row and then almost a 90% increase in 2010. We are not projecting big swings for 2011, 12, and 13, but there certainly could be those kinds of swings in there.
Dr. Stinson, if I might, Representative Biskins, I guess, has a question for right now.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Stinson, a couple of slides back, you used the phrase, since recession began. Could you tell us what year are you using? And is it a fiscal year or a calendar year?
Dr. Stinson.
Madam Chair, the National Bureau of Economic Research is the official arbiter of when recessions begin and when they end. And according to the National Bureau of Economic Research, the Great Recession began in December of 2007. And it concluded, and it reached its bottom point and started to turn up in June of 2009. So we've actually been out of the recession and in the recovery period for 6 months in 2009, a year in 2010, and a year in 2011. And we still haven't gotten our employment level back to the level it would be.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Dr. Stinson. But specifically to the question, you used the phrase since recession began. Are you saying December of 2007?
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, that's
okay.
That's
thank you.
It's monthly data.
All right. Thank you.
That brings us to the revenue chart, and here we have just very small changes in revenue. Income tax plus $48 million, 0.3%. It's less than $71 million, less than forecast for fiscal year 2012, and plus $119 million in 2013. The sales tax, $23 million. Corporate tax, $26 million negative in there. $45 million, 0.2% change in the three major taxes. All other revenues, including other taxes, other fee revenues and transfers, were up $48 million or 0.8%, total of $93 million or 0.3%. Let me turn it over to Margaret to talk about the spending part.
Well, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Margaret Kelly, State Budget Director. I'm going to speak to the slide up on the screen now. About almost three-quarters of this forecast gain, or $230 million, is from lowered spending, and this is comparing February to November's forecast. Over three-quarters of the lowered spending, or $180 million, is in the Health and Human Services budget, and specifically in medical assistance. The forecast changes in the MA budget is driven primarily by enrollment changes and, to a smaller extent, by lower costs. $108 million, almost 60% of the lowered MA spending, is due to lower enrollment in the MA Early Expansion Group. You may recall that this was a state option to the Federal Affordable Care Act that the department began implementing last March. And since we first forecasted this program last February, enrollment for this group has been revised downward by 16%, almost 6% in the November forecast and about 10% again in this forecast. This is a new program that the state has relatively little experience with, and so we have almost 12 months of actual experience now with this forecast so that going forward we are making our projections based on actual data as opposed to forecasted data in a year ago. If you exclude this eligibility group, the MA forecast change from November is relatively modest, less than 1%, which is more similar to the size of what we usually see in a February forecast. The remaining changes in the MA forecast are in our largest eligibility groups, family and kids, where enrollment growth has slowed. This eligibility group is most sensitive to the economy, and so as we've seen improvements in the economy, enrollment has declined in that group. The second large eligibility group with a forecast adjustment is the elderly and disabled, where fee-for-service payments are lower than expected. In other areas of the forecast, K-12 education spending has been lowered by $30 million in this forecast. Again, it's all about enrollment and slower growth in enrollment than we had anticipated back in November. And it's less than a 0.1% change in enrollment. Now, as a result of lowered, there are just a few other areas where there are adjustments in the forecast. In the aids and credits, a small reduction in projected spending there. Property tax levies came in a little lower than we had anticipated in November. In the debt service area, that has to do with the maximum effort school loan repayment program, legislation that passed last year, allowing school districts to pay off loans that they had from the state. More school districts paid off those loans than we anticipated, so lower debt service costs going out in the general fund. And a small technical adjustment in the state government area, an upper of about $5 million in the indirect cost area. So overall, $203 million of lowered spending. And combined with the revenue adjustments that we had on the other side of the forecast, we will have additional spending that will be put into the K-12 line of the budget. So the forecast spending that the available balance goes to buy down the K-12 shifts. So that line, the K-12 education line, will change from a $30 million reduction to a $283 million increase in spending. And overall spending from this forecast to last forecast will increase by $83 million when you adjust for the K-12 shift buybacks. There is one slide in here I just wanted to highlight. If this is on page 68 of the budget document. If people wanted more information about the MA adults without children eligibility category in the early expansion, how the forecast enrollment has been adjusted from February to November to this February.
Which brings us to, I think, some of the larger open questions of this forecast that will need to be addressed in next November and even a year from now in the subsequent 2013 February forecast. There are a number of federal policy issues that are still to be determined. And these issues, it's not unsurprising that there's federal policy issues to be determined, but the magnitude of them and the fiscal impact of them, as well as the impact on the GDP, is, I think, hard to underestimate. These include some of the sequestration actions and the level of spending reductions that might occur at the federal level, the expiring federal tax breaks, as well as implementation of the Affordable Care Act. All of these things have a significant flexibility and questions that will be resolved one way or another by Congress next fall, next winter, and as those occur, it can have a sizable impact on the GDP and ultimately on some of the revenue estimates that are showing up yet for this biennium and also for the next biennium.
Madam Chairman, you remember that this was an item of concern by the Council at the Council of Economic Advisors meetings, was the fiscal policy assumptions that Global Insight was carrying in their forecast. The graph that's on the screen here shows really three different forecasts. The shaded area that's dark is Congressional Budget Office's estimate of what the deficit will be under current law. That would include the automatic tax cuts, the payroll tax cut, the restoration of the payroll tax cut, the restoration of the Bush tax cuts, letting the AMT go on beyond, well, carry on at its current rate, and a bunch of other things. It turns out to be worth about $500 billion in fiscal drag. The area defined by the shaded area is the gap between current policy and current law. And that gap was worth about 3.7 percentage points in economic growth or in real GDP growth. The black line is Global Insight's forecast. It's a forecast that pretty well splits it down the middle, although it's not quite as austere at the start of 2013 as it is later. Nobody knows what is actually going to happen in November and December when Congress comes back into session to deal with some of these problems. And so we're not going to have that in our forecast in November and December as well. That means that the February forecast is going to be much more important in terms of your ability to set budgets and things like that. It also means that we're probably going to have a much larger error than normal in comparing the forecast that we have here compared to what will come out in February and where 12 and 13 will actually end up. Our estimates are that we normally have about a 3% error under normal conditions and so between now and then. 3% on $333 billion is about $1 billion, and so that's just about the equivalent of what we have in the reserve. Certainly we could be off either on a positive direction or a negative direction by more than $1 billion between now and the end of the biennium.
So there's still certainly fiscal issues that the state has to work through. We're happy to bring a second forecast that shows improvement in the budget situation since the last time we talked. However,
Commissioner, if I might, I guess Representative Gottwald has a question for right now.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, this is to any of our testifiers. Perhaps Mr. Stinson could address this as a two-piece question. And, I mean, since you brought the Affordable Care Act into this equation and the automatic federal spending reductions, I'm curious about two things. Number one, have we as a state estimated the total cost impact of implementing the ACA. And number two, in light of the automatic federal spending reductions and the deficit at the federal level, you know, we've heard talk of billions of dollars in subsidies coming to states under this program, and it seems that those are kind of in conflict with each other. How can you be reducing federal spending and increasing subsidies to states, and how reasonable is it that we can expect to get that here? So it's a two-part question.
Madam Chair.
Ms. Kelly.
Representative, I'll just speak to the first part in terms of the Affordable Care Act and its impact on Minnesota budget. We have not estimated how that is going to impact our budget in this forecast or the previous forecast, and anticipate we will begin to see that in the next November forecast.
Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Kelly, maybe you can address this as well. The second part of my question was, in light of the automatic federal spending reductions, do we have a lot of assurance or some concern about the adequacy of the federal subsidies that have been promised, especially out of the recent news coming out of Washington?
Ms. Kelly.
Madam Chair, Representative, that is a risk in the forecast.
Madam Chair.
Commissioner.
Representative, if I may add, the sequestration itself actually doesn't affect Medicaid. It affects all the discretionary programs. We have, I think your fiscal staff also have information from federal funds from FFIS. That gives a detail of some of the types of impacts. Most of those programs don't actually pass through the general fund. Most of those programs are coming through the federal funds, and Medicaid's off on the side. I think the risk and the question that Dr. Stinson is pointing out is, as Congress looks at a grand deal, as it looks at other options, how many new things that we can't really even anticipate could come into the mix? We don't know. Certainly don't know at this point, and that is one of those forecast risks that we just want to make sure that the legislature understands.
Representative Gottwald?
Madam Chair, just briefly, I mean, the point I'm trying to make is the law says that we will begin covering people, even those with existing coverage, up to 400% of federal poverty guideline, and that's a large number of Minnesotans, and that we will now see federal subsidies to offset that commitment that will eventually be backed off. And I assume some of that's been plowed into some of these projections for the state of Minnesota.
Yeah.
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative, it's really a planning estimate that's several years out, so it's not really dealing with the numbers that are at hand. I think some of the work that's being done at the state level to assess how to implement the exchange, how to implement ACA, are probably more important to the numbers at this point. So, Madam Chair, if I may continue then, certainly there are significant fiscal issues that we still need to work through. And that includes the issues coming from the federal government, also includes addressing some of the one-time resources that we use to balance the current budget that don't appear in 2014 and 15. As a result, we have a structural deficit. One-time resources only get used once. Ongoing commitments keep on showing up, and so what we have right now are estimating a $1.1 billion gap for the 2014-15 biennium. If there was any estimate of inflation on top of that, and this is a very simple, basic kind of approach to it, but you'd add about another $1 billion in spending pressures. So either way you look at it, we have still some work to do to address the state's financial picture, and that includes both on the budgetary basis, that also addresses is on the cash basis. There's issues in terms of making sure that we have, even with the reserves completely replenished, enough money on hand so that we can manage through fiscal 13 and going into 14 and 15. We will continue to be talking about this issue with you, but wanted to make sure that it's somewhat of a counterintuitive point that now that the rainy day fund has been replenished, that we could still be talking about cash flow issues. And the answer is yes, we can and will be talking about them because of the impacts of some of the school aid payment shifts, because of the underlying seasonality or monthly shape of some of our spending patterns and how those match up with revenues. So that, I think, pretty much concludes the bulk of the slides that we wanted to address specifically. I should note that since we initially released the forecast, on Friday afternoon with after consultation with fiscal staff and after consultation and documenting numbers with the Department of Education. One number has sort of moved within the forecast. The Department of Education cannot use the entire amount that we noted on an earlier slide for the education payment shift. As a result, $4.7 million is left over from that. That, by statute, is put into the budget reserve. So we have released a revised fund balance that will put that into the $653 million budget reserve, adding that $4.7 million to that. So that concludes our presentation, but very happy to take any questions the committee might have.
All right, thank you. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think that this, I don't know if this is for Mr. Stinson or not. Out of the, I'm going back to the education shift portion of things, and I'm just curious, and we put $318 million to pay back the shift. How much of that, how much then is left out of the $2.4 billion from the 60-40 shift, and how much of the $2.4 billion is actually from the 70-30 shift, which was passed, I believe, in 2009? Can you help me out on that?
And members, if you look at your packet, there's a historical timeline of the shifts on page 9. And it's up on the screen, too. Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative, there is, as you note, two different shifts. There's the aid payment shift and the property tax recognition shift. Maybe Ms. Kelly has a more precise breakdown, but the property tax recognition shift, as I recall, is about $600 to $700 million. The balance is on the aid payment shift. Working through the $2.4 billion that's outstanding, you have about $1.6 to $1.7 billion in aid payment shifts.
Madam Chair.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Commissioner Showalter. So what you're saying, the $600 to $700 million of the property recognition shift, that actually happened, I think that was in 2009. Is that correct?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes. The 2009-2010 session?
With 2000. I believe so.
And thank you.
Representative Anderson.
Madam Chair and Commissioner Showalter, so then the remaining, I think you said $1.6 billion, was that completely from the 70-30 shift that was enacted in, I believe, 2009 as well?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative, there's been basically the last three legislative sessions have impacted these numbers, getting us to the 60-40 that we started this forecast at.
Representative Anderson.
Okay, so Madam Chair, what we're looking at really from the 60-40 that was enacted in 2011, there's maybe about $400 million left of that. Is that correct?
Commissioner Showalter.
Madam Chair and Representative Metzler, we fought the going from 70-30 to 60-40 last session saved about $715 million. And with this buyback, we brought back about half of that. So we're going from a 60-40 shift to about a 64.3 and 35.7 shift.
Okay.
All right, Representative Kahn. I'm sorry, Representative Anderson, were you done?
I just want to make sure I've got my numbers correct, Madam Chair. So, Ms. Kelly, so we're looking at $2 billion, you know, if you knock off from the 2.4, you got about 400 left. About $2 billion of that is from the 70-30 shift and the property tax recognition shift that was enacted in 2009.
Madam Chair,
Ms. Kelly,
that sounds correct.
Great, thank you, Representative Kahn.
Yes, Madam Chairman and members of the discussion team, I've long advocated. You know, I understand why we need the cash flow account, and that's a good thing. But I've long advocated getting rid of the budget reserve and replacing it with a trigger tax, which I think would do just as well in how outside, which meant that in a time of an economic downturn, you would get your extra money by putting whatever size tax increase you needed on the income tax. And the advantage I see to that is that when the budget reserve goes down, we invariably cut things that hurt the poorest people in the state. And if we replace it with a trigger tax, we only affect people who aren't being affected by the economic downturn. Is there any, I know you're proposing it, is there any ongoing discussion about that at all, at any time?
Commissioner Showalter.
Madam Chair, Representative Pound, I am not aware of any discussions along those lines. The I think the point on cash flow that's important is that we need lead time, so that a trigger tax and the timing of the collections of those revenues would need to sort of be your mechanism to replenish the budget reserve. I don't know that it would get rid of the budget reserve, but it would make sure that, you know, we always had that, and we couldn't really spend it down. And if we started to spend it down, we would end up replenishing it, if I'm understanding your point correctly.
No, my point is Madam Chairman, my point is that we don't, the cash flow account is something totally different, mm-hmm. and I understand why we need a cash flow account. But my point is that instead of having this additional money in a budget reserve, the replacement for that would be a trigger tax when the economy turns down. And the argument for that, which I'll repeat, is that the money then comes for people who haven't been affected by the downturn because their incomes are still, as opposed to the general public and the state and people who have been severely affected by it.
Madam Chair.
Commissioner Showalter.
Representative, I think I follow, and that would work. The piece that doesn't work as well is that the cash flow account at $350 million isn't anywhere close to the amount that's necessary to handle the cash flow needs of the state. And so there would need to be a significant discussion about increasing that number, because even with about $1 billion in reserves, there isn't the mechanism, or at least at this point, we're still looking at possibly negative balances, and we will find that out as we try to perfect our numbers.
Madam Chairman, just so, can we have some discussion then, or some analysis of how the cash flow account works and when it dips below the amount that's in it, and when the state's credit isn't good enough to say, hey, we're going to fill that again with the trigger tax mechanism?
And Representative Kahn, on page 7 and 8 of the handout are some basic graphs. I think we'll have more discussion around this issue this morning, and the MMB is going to need some time to refine what the ramifications of the payback of the shift are with that analysis. But I think it's something that a lot of people are concerned about. Representative Abler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have a little question about the roundoff piece. There's $4.6 million that doesn't fit into the whole number, and that goes into the reserve temporarily. So is that a new limit? Is that a new number that we push the reserve up statutorily, or is that just how does that ever go away? Or if you get a few more pennies, then you can add that to another whole tenth of a percent, and that goes back to pay off some more shift? How does that work?
I've seen that.
Commissioner Showalter.
Madam Chair, Representative, current law says that the shift buyback happens to the nearest tenth of a percent. So anything left over, current law directs to go into the budget reserve, and therefore it would not be available for future shift buybacks. We would, if there were a forecast in November that had a positive balance, that positive balance would again buy down the shift to the nearest 10%. And if there were a remaining increment, that again would go into the budget reserve.
But, Madam Chair, the 4.6 would be added into the future forecast to try to get one more tenth of a percent. Is that how it would work? It's a new addition. It's like the little coins in your bank, and it's okay. Thank you,
Ms. Kelly.
Madam Chair, Representative, it would be in the reserves as a part of the forecasted reserves.
And Representative Abler and committee members, there is a memo from MMB in your packet explaining this with a spreadsheet as well. All right, Representative Carlson.
Madam Chair, going back to discussion of the cash flow, as you know, when we had a special committee dealing with the budget a couple of years ago, there was a fair amount of discussion about how to handle the cash flow, and do we still have a line of credit in place if that were needed, if you did have a shortfall?
Commissioner Showalter.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, for fiscal year 2012, we do have a line of credit in place. As the slides suggest, at this point, we are getting past the second set of low points right now. And while I expect our balances actually will be somewhat lower than this, because we will be making payments to school districts to start paying back the school district on March 15th, we'll be paying more than $200 million. by the end of this fiscal year, we're paying $300 million, more than what we're showing on this chart. But that all being said, we have a line of credit for this fiscal year if necessary. That line of credit expires at the end of the fiscal year. We do not have an agreement that goes into fiscal 13. So we will need to assess whether a new line of credit or other kind of borrowing mechanism would be appropriate.
Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Madam Chair, that kind of leads into my next question, because you had two or three tools in the toolbox when we were having that discussion. And when you say you might look at other alternatives, what might they be if you didn't use the line of credit?
Commissioner Showalter.
Madam Chair, Representative, great question, because candidly, some of those tools aren't in the toolbox at this point. With this forecast, for instance, one of the changes to the collection dates on the sales tax triggers off. So there will be one collection timeline for the sales tax. That will negatively impact the cash flow by about $100 million based upon our current estimates. There's a brief write-up of that in the forecast document. The changes that we were able to make with the school districts a couple years ago also were repealed last year. So some of that borrowing is also not there, or some of those payment changes are not there. So while we have some limited tools, they probably aren't of the magnitude that were available even 3 or 4 years ago.
Okay. Madam Chair, thank you.
Thank you. Representative Greiley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And members, I just wanted to put in my oar after listening to Representative Anderson. And I got the impression that she was making the case about, you know, comparing size of shifts and when they took place and how much has been paid back and how much, therefore, would be left just from the last biennium and so forth, that she might consider herself responsible for. And I would say, members, if we look on page 9 of the handout, that we can show that, you know, we've, all of us sitting here, have been responsible for borrowing from the schools. And I would like to make the case that that a large part of that, while we're all jointly responsible for voting for increasing the school shift, I think a lot of that, and I certainly would speak for when I was the education chair and the shift went up even more than it did this biennium, that I would put the responsibility for that on any members or any governors who were of the no new taxes mind. If people signed pledges or not, if you voted that way or, you know, were impossible to vote any other way, then those, when we bipartisanly wanted to protect schools, we end up then with unprecedented borrowing from schools. And we know that only Minnesota and California does this. Other states, when they either raise some taxes or they actually cut education. And I think we're at the end of the road here now with borrowing from our schools. So we'll have to, I think in the next session, the gig is up about this. We'll have to, or those of you who are still here, will have to either cut schools or raise taxes. I don't think there's too many other ways to do it. And I would, Representative Kahn, much prefer your idea of a trigger tax to constantly using the schools for state banking cash flow, which is what we have been doing. And I think the responsibility for that lays at the hands of those who haven't been willing to compromise on any sort of a tax increase.
Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I find it interesting. In 2004, I was elected, and we came in with a deficit, and I was in the majority. We were in the majority of the Republicans. By the end of 2006, took that deficit and turned it into about a $2 billion surplus from the policies that were passed. We then lost the majority, and the $2 billion surplus over the course of about 4 years was spent into about a $5 or $6 billion deficit. We then won back the majority in 2011 and addressed the $5 or $6 billion budget deficit, and we're looking at about $1 billion surplus. I just wanted to point that out over the course of my tenure. We can sit and point fingers, but I tell you what, we all need to take a hard look in the mirror as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hamilton. Representative Gottwald.
You're still Gottwald, right?
Yes, I am. I'm sorry, I didn't hear my name quite straight. Madam Chair, and to Mr. Stinson or whoever would be responsible for it, Ms. Kelly, I think it is absolutely essential, and I would make this a request, that at some point we come back with a better or firmer estimate of what the ACA is going to do to the state of Minnesota financially. These are not small dollars, and they are not small impacts to either our economy or our state costs. I'd sound an alarm as well, but we need to have some projection of that. I think it is absolutely unconscionable that by 2013 we are going to ask to begin implementing this thing, and we don't even know what it's going to cost the state of Minnesota or our economy. And I think we do need those projections. I'm not really blaming you, but I would like to see that coming back. We need some projections of the impacts.
Madam Chair, Representative Gottwald, I appreciate that concern, and just one comment that there are a lot of decisions that are yet to be made to align our programs with federal eligibility requirements. There are a number of task forces and stakeholder groups that are doing that work now to help inform us as to how to make those estimates, and that's where we're at.
All right, Representative Westrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Couple questions for the testifiers, but first, Representative Kahn, I need to correct your statement. Maybe those of your constituents in Minneapolis that have some wealth built up weren't affected when the economy turns down, but let me tell you about a constituent I just talked to Friday night. 5 years ago, going into 08, had $9 million in net worth. He's now filed bankruptcy and driving truck on the road because the economy has affected him as well. I don't think you would have put him in the poor category. Representative Kahn, I think you should rethink that, because I think most everybody, wherever they fit on the economic ladder, wherever they are in the entry of the business world, or they're starting a job or starting a company, have been affected. I find that week in and week out, time and time again, and it's an inaccurate statement when you say only one sector of our population has been affected, because I think it's affected just about everybody. Maybe there's somebody that's completely been immune from it, but I haven't found that person yet. So, Madam Chair, two questions. And I'm not, whoever wants to answer this, there was the discussion about the schools were able to pay back some of the money sooner than expected, and that was some savings. Can you expand on that a little bit more, and what can you read from that number? Are there healthier balances in our schools, and are generally our schools in decent fiscal shape with adequate reserves to be able to handle some of that, or is there nothing to read out of that scenario?
Madam Chair, Representative
Showalter.
I'm not sure. I'm going to take a stab at the question, because certainly the payments going from the state to schools were more predicated on, I think, the state's financial needs and the agreement that we would settle up any entitlement payments over a two-year period. The situation of repaying the schools as done in this forecast isn't based upon any assessment of schools' financial health. It's really more assessment of the state's financial health, where we have more than $300 million of forecast balance available through the rest of this biennium, and we will change our payment schedule to try and get them a little bit higher than they are under current law and under the current sort of fiscal assumptions based on the end of last session. So it's really not based upon the assessment of a school. It's really based upon the payment mechanism that the state makes to those schools.
Thank you, Commissioner. Second question, Madam Chair. And we've kind of touched on this with the whole idea of a trigger tax instead of a rainy day fund. Let me ask kind of the opposite end, and you've touched on this, Commissioner. I think reading between the lines, you maybe gave us an indication as a committee that the cash flow account and maybe even with the rainy day fund is smaller than it needs to be at times when there's expenses being paid out. And that was my question before you got into that topic. When do we change the rainy day fund amount or the cash flow account, or what triggers those levels? Because they have been at those levels as long as I can remember, and that's well over a decade now. I think Governor Carlson was talking about these same levels, and yet our budget, as the size of our state grows, as expenses go up, our budget's gone up virtually every year. Do we ever track and have those accounts start mimicking or being a percentage or some other indicator with the budget? Because it does seem like maybe we don't have even adequate reserves right now. Can you comment on that?
Commissioner Showalter.
Madam Chair, Representative, thanks for the comment and question. Because certainly the budget reserves are a constant source of question as to what's the right level. And it's really a matter of risk tolerance. The numbers for the cash flow and budget reserve are set in statute. So it's not based upon a formula. It's not based upon an inflator. You're correct. They are the same numbers that we have been working with for quite a number of years. It is a difficult thing to address. At times there have been discussions of raising those numbers, but it's always a question of priorities as to putting money in the budget reserve or taking the risk, essentially, of a downturn as we have in the last couple of years.
Madam Chair.
Representative Westrom.
Just on that point, Commissioner, I mean, if we had a billion and a half budget reserve, I mean, I suppose there's is there a better number that you or anybody in your department suggests, given a $33 billion budget, that would cushion against at least modest ebbs and flows?
Madam Chair, Representative, absolutely. Given the position I'm in, I would say any number that's larger is a better number. Because really, you know, I'm responsible for trying to manage that risk, and that's both on a cash and a budgetary basis. So I think, you know, we would say yes, we would want to put aside money for a budget reserve. Dr. Stinson and his team have done a number of very unique analyses trying to assess the fluctuation and variability of some of our revenue streams. Have come up with a couple of different estimates for how large that reserve might be under a couple of different scenarios. If you'd like to speak to that, we could certainly go into that further.
Madam Chair, parting comment. I suppose we could implement the Dave Ramsey recommendation, which is typically 6 months of an emergency fund if all things go bad, but maybe that's a little excessive in this case.
Thank you for those comments, Representative Westrom. Representative Lomcheski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess my question, well, if I may, I have a question for Mr. Marks, who I just sent him a note, and he was going to send me it back, and I might as well just say it into the microphone. You know, I'm just trying to think through, because we're into this whole cash flow, budget reserve, trigger tax, you know, what's the size of the question, which is sort of off of, I guess, what we're doing here today, but since people are interested in it, I know for bonding, we have the ability, or we have in law, that if you the way you back the state bonds in a worst case scenario, I don't think it's ever happened, is a statewide property tax. I think you know that, Madam Chair, but a lot of legislators don't know that if all else fails, the legislature implements a statewide property tax to pay for that. And my question is that mechanism in place for spending right now? And I just wondered if Mr. Marks can tell us that.
Mr. Marks.
Madam Chair and Representative Lomcheski, no, not for spending, just for state and specifically for general obligation bonds, not necessarily other types of bonds. And it's the language in the law is in the Constitution, and it would, and then the language in the law implementing it would direct the state auditor to implement a statewide tax, and it's in the case that there would not be enough money, not enough general fund appropriation or from other sources to pay off general obligation bonds.
Representative Lomcheski.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to know that. Just But I guess I just have a question for you, just hearing from, you know, Mr. Showalter and his staff has done a great job for a long time, bipartisanly, under Governor Plenty, Governor Dayton, saying, deal with this cash flow issue for us. And as you know, Madam Chair, Representative Carlson and I worked closely with Governor Plenty to help out on the cash flow problems, put some temporary things in place. Representative Carlson was just asking if the credit line was still there, and you're very well of this, Madam Chair, and now you're in kind of charge of thinking that through in your leadership for all of us. And I just kind of listening to members, you know, I think every member here can do a great job of showing how, like, the Democrats really were responsible and the Republicans really stink, or the Republicans were really great and the Democrats stink. And, you know, we all have our view on these big picture things, but you know, we do have a responsibility to Minnesotans from just a pure budgeting standpoint, you know, kind of setting down the swords for a second and just thinking about what we could do to make life better for all the folks who are actually dealing with this day to day. And, you know, there's so many pieces. You know, that line we saw on the spreadsheet that has what it would cost if we had an inflation. And I think you remember this, Madam Chair. I was the author of that provision, so we even get to see that line. So remember, inflation was taken out in some of the years Representative Hamilton was talking about as a way to balance the budget and not count inflation. So, you know, I had a bill to put it back in. We don't have it for the budget total, but we at least get to see it. So that's like another speed bump to help us in budgeting. And I guess, you know, thinking through this, you know, there's these other pieces that we're not talking about today, like the elimination of the homestead credit. I mean, if that was back, that's another $540 million we'd have to find. So it's not just, you know, it's the cuts, the property tax increases that are happening. You know, there's all kinds of stuff happening here. And we haven't even mentioned, to my mind, the big shift that's problematic or gimmick is the tobacco money. I mean, that was selling a revenue stream of the future. The school shifts, I'm not really like most people on my side, don't have a big problem with them. I think we've all done them bipartisanly, and I think they are a good sort of deposit backdrop as we hurdle through a difficult budget time. And so are some of these other things, like not counting inflation. But, you know, going forward, you know, I do think you're really the leader who has to decide for your caucus. Are you guys going to address this year some of these issues we're talking about over and over and over, this cash flow problem? I mean, it's really real. If you set aside who's in charge, Republicans or Dems, they really cannot continue on like this. And with all due respect to Representative Kahn, I'm not a trigger tax fan. But I do think we need to think about some of this stuff. And do you intend to kind of work on that with maybe Representative Carlson, Governor Dayton, to see if, you know, if our citizens knew that they're really like moving pots of money around quickly to not have us go under, and I think it's your committee that have to do it. I'd love to help on it if you're going to pursue it. If it's just something not doable this year, I understand, because sometimes the political climate isn't there. But I'd love to just hear your thoughts on this problem.
Well, thank you, Representative Lucheski. And once we get through all the people that have questions, I have a set of my own that hopefully we'll get to. We also have two bills to do today as well. But certainly we have to gather more information. There's ramifications for cash flow, whether or not we'll have to look at another line of credit or not. And hopefully we'll get to some of those questions today. But certainly I am concerned. You know me, I'm not a big spender. Yeah. I've been saying no to a lot of people, particularly since Thursday, and I can continue to do that pretty easily, we all know ultimately the decisions that are made here are made by the body as a whole, but I don't think we have all the information yet as far as cash flow analysis, et cetera. I'm hoping that the department will move as rapidly as possible. I'm sure they have these same concerns and will be looking at that. And I've got, I think, four more people that want to ask questions, and we'll get there. Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I wanted to comment a little bit about the so-called swing of the $1 billion and referring to that as a surplus. In my view, we don't really have a surplus. If you look at the very first chart that we were provided with, on page one, it shows available balance zero. And I think just to remind folks of what goes into that, some of these numbers, the tobacco bonds, which created a 20-year obligation netted us $643 million. Those bonds were issued not long before the November forecast. So those numbers are artificially high, in my view, with just that $643 million, which, by the way, that's a net number because we did pay a couple of years of interest. And then if we want to begin to use that kind of terminology, I think we have to look at that last chart that we were provided this morning, the $1.1 billion gap. Title says we improved slightly. With property tax recognition shift in the schools, we owe about $2.3 billion. So that's $3.4 billion before we even get to what Representative Lencheski was referencing about inflation, which puts us over $4 billion as we go into the next biennium. So I would caution people in terms of trying to create too rosy a picture based on this year where we have an available balance of zero and continue to have over $4 billion in obligations when we move 1 year out. Thank you.
Representative Sarah Anderson, and then I have Garofalo and Kahn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll be brief. Dr. Stinson-Hewen mentioned earlier the 2.9% growth in jobs since the low in September of 2009. Do you have an exact number of how many jobs have increased since then?
Dr. Stinson.
Madam Chairman, Representative Anderson, let me see. I've got it. I just have to find the right piece of paper.
If you want to just get back to me on it, too.
Let's go to Representative Garofalo's question and we'll give Dr. Stinson a minute. Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Dr. Stinson, Commissioner Showalter, for being here. And I know I speak for the entire legislature, Commissioner, when I say that the best news from this forecast is that whenever we have positive news, the Star Tribune has that big toothy smiley picture of you standing behind the podium that they put on their website every time. So I don't need to read the article. I just need to see the picture, and if it's there, I know it's good news. And I know that Minnesota's on the right track. So thanks. Thank you, Commissioner. Just a couple of quick items. Number one, you alluded in your testimony to the fact that we repealed, I think it's 127A46. This where MMB used to have the authority, in addition to the payment shift, to be able to meter out payments and basically tap into the cash flow accounts that individual school districts have. And I just want to make sure that I understand it properly, that last year when we pulled that out of statute, we took that ability away from you, and there's not some sort of hidden paragraph or hidden secret emergency authority that you have that doesn't allow MMB to modify those payments without legislative authority.
Commissioner Showalter.
Madam Chair, Representative, you piqued my interest in looking again. But I am not aware of any end run on that.
And Madam Chair. And
Representative Garofalo.
Commissioner, as you know, we modified the payment schedule to charter schools so that they're actually being paid on a 90-10 rate right now in identical payments. And now that we've moved above the 60-40 time frame, absent legislative action, future payments are actually going to be going in at an accelerated rate of 90-10, and if the trend lines continue, we could end up in a situation where next January we're actually going to be paying charter schools in their preliminary payments above 100% of their entitlement. And I'm just wondering if the department has looked at this and has any thoughts on some legislative action that maybe we should engage in this year to the unintended side effects of good news. And if you just have any thoughts or if you prefer to speak offline about that, Commissioner.
Commissioner Showalter.
Madam Chair, Representative, we will be happy to follow up with you. I don't have anything at this point.
Okay. All right. Dr. Stinson, did you find your number for Representative Anderson?
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, Minnesota lost 148,000 jobs from the start of the recession to the lowest point. We've regained 75,000 jobs, or about 50% of them back. Nationally, we've gained 36% back.
Representative Anderson? Representative Kahn?
Madam Chairman, somewhat belatedly, my response to Representative Westrum and now Representative Lencheski, but the comment that what the trigger tax does is it is based on the thought on the belief that we have a fair income tax system. If our income tax system, and so that the income tax system is still collecting based on people's incomes coming in at that time. If it's not fair, then I intend that then we need people who know much more about taxes than I do, like Representative Lencheski, to fix it, to make it fair. I just do what she tells me to. And I will point out that even though she has this moral opposition to a trigger tax, I did finally get something that I had worked on for maybe 20 years that she also had a moral obligation objection to into law, and something that's been very good for the state, the historic preservation tax credit. So I win one once in a while. So
well, I think more just than continue. Once in a while, Representative Gunther.
No.
All righty. Representative Gunther, did you have a question?
Well, you know, Dr. Stinson piqued my curiosity. He said we lost approximately 70,000 jobs. Where do we lose those to? Are those jobs no longer here, or they aren't filled?
Dr. Stinson.
Madam Chairman, Representative, we lost about 150,000 jobs. We've gotten 75,000 of them back. Okay, that means that we need to add another 75,000. These aren't jobs that are not filled. These are jobs that are not where employers don't necessarily require workers at this time. Now there's an issue, and the issue is, do we have a job skills mismatch? And certainly some of that is true. We have an inordinate amount of construction workers, for example, who have lost their jobs, and they had skills that were demanded by the market in the construction trades, and now those skills aren't demanded as much as they were in the past. And so there's a question of whether we can solve some of the problem by retraining, but the jobs numbers themselves are pretty bleak still.
Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is one of the ways we can get those jobs back is by increasing the number of industries that move into our state with new jobs that we hadn't had before the recession?
Madam
Chair.
Dr.
Stinson.
Representative Gunther, certainly that's one way, but another way is just to encourage the growth of existing industries in the state as well.
Okay, thank you.
Commissioner Showalter, with the documents that you've put forth here that show your initial cash flow analysis on page 7 and 8, was that done with the calculation of the shift being paid back? Is that figured in yet, or?
Madam Chair, no. These are based upon the November forecast. So at that point in time, we had not put the additional $5 million in the rainy day fund, and we had not assumed any repayment of the shift. As I mentioned earlier, the repayment of the shift is assuming some of the decreases in expenditures and some of the increases in revenues throughout the rest of the biennium and starting to pay those out starting on March 15th. So in all likelihood, the paying back that shift will in fact bring some of these numbers down in fiscal 12 and make 13 even a little bit worse.
And do you know what kind of timeline we're looking at that you can have that analysis done for us?
Madam Chair, I don't have a firm date at this point. We're working through some of the expenditure assumptions. As you know, these are daily estimates of when healthcare payments will be made, education payments will be made, but we're assuming in the next couple of weeks we'll have something for you. As soon as we're able to, we will share it with the committee. As soon as we have estimates, we'll share it with the committee and we'd be happy to come back and talk about it further.
But if I might, given the timeline of the next payment being March 15th, how much additional money goes out in that March 15th payment? Do you know?
Madam Chair, a little over $200 million.
All right. So we're, as far as if there was any need to meter that, you'd have to get this cash flow analysis done much earlier than 2 weeks if we were to be able to work with that issue. And my understanding is that the line of credit expires at the end of this fiscal year. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, correct.
Have you done any preliminary analysis about re-upping that, if you will? If you think you're going to need to do that, or...
Madam Chair, that'll be certainly part of the analysis we will do once we get past the sort of the detailed February cash flow estimates. My assumption is that there will be sort of the question that will come up in May, whether our refunds, whether our collections came on track, or whether we're running a little bit better than estimated. But after that, we don't have a lot of ways to change the arc of it. So at that point, we'll take a look at whether it's pretty certain that we would need cash flow, in which case we'd probably just do a simple bond issue, short-term cash, like many states do, or whether we have the chance to manage past it, in which case then we'd probably look towards a line of credit. There's sort of flexibility and cost implications of both tools, and we would certainly come back and raise those issues.
And I've had a couple of the governor's agency people, in some cases commissioners, other maybe assistant commissioners or sub-agency heads, for lack of a better term, come to me with issues relative to more spending, problems, unanticipated things. They've stopped short of confirming whether or not the governor was going to have a supplemental budget. I'm wondering if you can answer that question today, whether there will be a supplemental budget from the governor, and what you would see as a timeline on that.
Madam Chair, I expect that there will be a supplemental request from the governor, and it should be available very soon, within days.
All right. Great. Thank you. Representative Kiffmeyer, did you have a quick question before we wrap this up and move on to the two bills on the agenda?
Yes, I do, Madam Chair. And Dr. Stinson, in regards to the subject of jobs, in my district we have manufacturers who have jobs but cannot find the qualified, skilled employees to meet those jobs. And it's a real issue for them. They don't need four-year degrees. They're very skill-oriented in manufacturing, but they like the one- or two-year, you know, well-grounded type of skills. Is this true of what you see around the state or any national as well impact in regards to that specific area?
Madam Chair, Representative Kiffmeyer. Yes, that's the skills mismatch problem that we have. There are jobs in the healthcare area as well, but if you're a carpenter who's been laid off, you don't have the skills required to afford you a job in the healthcare area or as a machinist or some other skilled manufacturing area job. So, you know, that's the challenge really, is how do we make sure that people that want to work and that had skills that were marketable 5 years ago are able to retool themselves and find employment elsewhere.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's it.
Thank you, Representative Kiffmeyer. Well, thank you very much for coming today. We hope you got some rest over the weekend. I know last week was a busy week for you. We appreciate the information. And as always, members, if you have additional questions, certainly feel free to contact our friends at MMB. Thank you very much. Representative Murdoch, you are next on the agenda. And I will move House File 1595 for consideration by the committee. Welcome to the committee, Representative Murdoch. Generally, we don't take any testimony from individuals or the public in this meeting. We basically will look at your fiscal note, which now appears to be a zero. So if you'd like to briefly explain your bill from the committee, we would appreciate it.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, good morning. Right, it's right. There's a fiscal note zero on the bill. The bill deals with manufactured homes and titles to homes. Sometimes, back a few years ago, we changed the law, and this makes a change to the law that if you sell your manufactured home, the title goes with it. It's not tied to the property, is basically the bill. And I think there's probably 15 or 20 of these a year that we need to do, with my information from Mr. Bruner here to my left. So it's dealing with the titles to manufactured homes, separating them from real property.
All right.
From land.
Members, are there any questions for Representative Murdoch? Representative Pavina.
Well, Representative Murdoch, I think it's a pretty good bill, because I see some of the inequities that develop because of the problem you're trying to address. But I'm just wondering if Pat McCormick and, you know, the public safety should be the one to do it. Maybe somebody at Commerce could do it more easily or quicker. I know poor Ms. McCormick, I'd probably give her a full-time job just trying to get my constituents their driver's licenses back. So and she's my main contact. And I hate to have you doing other things, you know, because my folks got to get a license back. So isn't really, no, but seriously, isn't Commerce maybe a better place to do this than... Why would you have Public Safety and Department of Vehicle Services doing a home, basically?
May I have Mr. Bruner address that?
Certainly. Welcome to committee, Mr. Bruner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mark Bruner, Manufactured Modular Home Association of Minnesota. You know, I guess, Representative Rubina, it's just where the titling is housed or has always been housed for the state of Minnesota. Manufactured homes, since they were... first started being constructed in the 1940s, have had titles, and that's just where the processing has taken place for all titles in the state. I mean, we'd certainly be open to looking at other options, but...
And Representative Rucavini, if you look at the bill, it went to both Commerce and Transportation, so I think they already had that fight.
Well, I'm just... Mr. Chair, I'm sure I'm not the only one that have people constant. I know Representative Hamilton is that. They call me from Representative Hamilton's district. So I'm sure all of us around the table have had these problems with, you know, public safety and getting licenses back. I just don't want to put too much pressure on Ms. McCormick because she really is good.
Thank you, Representative Rucavina. Representative Beard.
We did have this fight, Madam Chair, and transportation. Fight isn't the word. It was a discussion because we were trying to shed light and understand what we were asked into doing. And Representative Murdoch, if I remember right, this is like less than 20 titles a year. It was a very small number. It was not a very complicated deal, Madam Chair. That's the point.
All right, thank you. Any additional questions for the bill author or his testifier? Seeing none, I will renew my motion that House File 1595 be recommended by us and referred to the General Register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Representative Murdoch, you're on your way to the floor. Thank you very much for your patience today.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members.
Representative Fabian, you're up next.
Madam Chair, I'd move this bill if you want.
Representative McNamara moves House File 2095 for consideration by the committee. And we have two amendments in our packet. I think the A12 is the... Okay, the A12 amendment, my understanding, is an author's amendment. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, that's correct, yes.
All right, and it's my understanding that this amendment affects the fiscal note of the bill. Is that correct?
Yes, Madam Chair.
All right. Representative McNamara, would you like to move the A12 amendment?
Yes, Madam, I would.
Madam Chair.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I see this affects the fiscal note in some way, but it's also a major policy change. And I was surprised to see this amendment in our packet. And I'm looking particularly on the back of it, on lines starting with 2.1. And a permit is deemed complete unless it's clearly, this is done by an outside professional, unless it's clearly erroneous under statute or rule. We did not see that language in the Environment Committee, and it seems that it, and we didn't see that the agency shall approve it within 5 days. I don't know how many people that's going to take in PCA or anything like that. And if PCA has not done a fiscal note on this piece of it, it does seem that it should go back to Environment for that work.
And Representative Wagenius and certainly Representative Fabian can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the department has had the opportunity to look at this and is willing to testify to the implications of this for their agency. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, yes, that's correct.
Maybe we can just slow down just a second. Would you explain the amendment to the committee, and then we'll work ourselves through the process here.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, thanks for hearing House File 2095 today. As many of you remember from the last session, we passed House File 1 to streamline the permitting process and all the things that were involved with that. This is a continuation of that. It's kind of almost an extension of some of the governor's work that he's been doing with regards to this. It's about a lot of different things. The amendment, the A12 amendment, if you were to turn to page 4 in the bill, if you have that in front of you. Beginning 4.7 through 4.33, in essence, what we're doing is we're deleting that part of the bill. A lot of work has been done in the last few days with MPCA, Mr. Smith and Mr. Kudelka. I was not involved in those. Tony Quillis has been very much involved in this. I had a family situation this weekend that required my attention, so I was not involved in those, but they brought me up to date this morning. MPCA is comfortable. And I would say that with regards to Representative Wagenius's concerns, this is simply the application. This is not the permit. This is the application that we're doing here. And, Madam Chair, I heard you say earlier that you're not a big spender, I believe. I'm not a very good poker player, and I didn't want to call your bluff on that. So this amendment, according to MPCA, brings the fiscal statement down by $734,000. The bill still has a cost of about $44,000. We're continuing to work with MPCA on that, and we think that we're very, very close to getting the fiscal note down to zero. So one of the things that this bill is trying to do is also to free up time within the agency by having the permit professional doing some of the work that the agency used to do.
All right, thank you. Is there somebody from the agency that would like to speak to this amendment?
I believe Kirk is.
Fiscal impact. Welcome to the committee. If you'll state your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Chair and committee members. My name is Kirk Adelk. I'm the legislative director with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. The change in the provision for the permit professional and the way that policy would be done for this new category does remove the costs and the fiscal note on page 7. If you look at the chart, it does remove the third box there, which is for $484,000, and then the fourth box there, which is for a total of about $250,000 per year. As the author mentioned, that does remove about $740,000 from the fiscal note, significantly reducing it.
All right, and then it's my understanding that you're okay with the remaining balance of the $44,000. That's a number that you can work with under your current appropriations. Is that correct?
Chair and committee members, we're still working on the whole bill at this point, and as the author mentioned, we're continuing to work on to improve its policy and financial provisions in it.
All right. Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Kudelka, at this time, does the governor support the bill then?
Mr. Kudelka.
Chair and committee members, at this point, we're still working with the chamber and the author on the bill. There are some concerns that the agencies have. We'll make that decision once we're at the end of the bill and be able to tell what the final product looks like. I think a little premature at this point for us to say what the end product's going to be.
All right, Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the author. What are some of the tasks in terms of the permit application process that you see specifically shifting from the agency to the permit proposer under your legislation?
Representative Hornstein, can we deal with the amendment issue first? And I'm not sure if that's directly to the amendment.
Okay.
Maybe it is.
but I'm happy to wait.
Let's go with Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It seems to me that we should choose as a committee. I know I could make a motion to move this back to committee. You may want to hear it, keep it here, but this is not a bill that's ready to go to the floor. One of the other options should be taken to have PCA say what the fiscal note is, if they can absorb it. They don't know whether they can absorb it. This bill is not ripe. And I don't think it's been this committee has been good, actually, about having discipline within Ways and Means. And with that discipline, I think that this bill at this time should either remain in this committee until things are worked out or be sent back at your preference to the Environment Committee.
All right. Thank you for your comments, Representative Wagenius. Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Fabian, for addressing the financial concerns. I believe, Madam Chair, that both the agencies, the MPCA in that $44,000 and the DNR's $8,000, the DNR, I clearly have had conversations with them that they can absorb the $8,000, and I believe it certainly is within the realm that MPCA would be able to absorb this $44,000. And from the testimony from Mr. Kadelka, you could get in his words, he's just about ready to say that. He wasn't quite there. I think they're still interested in negotiating the bill.
Thank you. Are there any other questions on the amendment? Is it Representative Wagenius?
Well, Madam Chair, for one, I'm going to vote against the amendment because, I mean, its underlying premise is wrong, but it's premature. We don't even know. On both counts, we should not be voting on this at this time. We haven't talked about the underlying premise of this bill, but one of the strange things in here is a this deem complete unless it's clearly erroneous under statute and rule. We haven't discussed what complete versus clearly erroneous is. There's a huge gap there. And what does that mean for the public? Because it's the public that's going to be have to deal with something that is deemed complete on one hand. It's not clearly erroneous. Maybe it's just partially erroneous. Where does that put Minnesota public when they want to comment on a bill like this? So it looks like all the benefits of this amendment go to the business that is proposing to add pollution, either air pollution or water pollution, and all the benefits are being taken away from Minnesota citizens. So I think this is a really, for Minnesotans, this is not good. And I still think it's premature because we haven't figured out both the dollar amount and what this huge gap means for the Minnesota public. I know that the chamber would love this. I mean, if I were the chamber, I'd love this bill too. But what about just Minnesotans who live in the community next to the proposed facility?
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, first of all, Representative Wagenius, again, it's the application. It's not the final on the permit. We still have to go through all the public comments. If you look at the amendment on lines 2.9, 2.10, 2.11, there again, we have to go through all of the timetables, the 60 days, the public comments, the public hearings. And then at that point, it's the permit is either approved or it's not. It's not a final issue. It's just one more step. And again, what we're trying to do is speed up the process. We're encouraging lots of communication between the proposer, the permit professional, the MPCA right up front at the very beginning of the process. We've got meetings that are being established in this bill. We're trying to open up the lines of communication so that people know specifically what they need to do. That being said, the permit professionals, our engineers, they have a stake in terms of their reputation and their employment in the future. They can't be doing a poor job on putting these applications together. They have a code of ethics within their community that they have to abide by. And I with all due respect to Representative Wagenius, I don't think that that you can characterize business as people who want to pollute. Thank you.
Representative Wagenius.
Well, Madam Chair, these basic permits are permits to add pollution, either air pollution or water pollution. Maybe it's not right to characterize that they want to pollute, but that's the end result of what, why they're getting the permit. And here's one of the problems, just for members who in this body deal a lot with conflicts of interest. We are talking about someone who is going to write this permit to add additional pollution and has no duty to the public. In fact, one of the things we did in committee, I made a motion for an amendment to add a duty of candor. And the reason I did that is because every pollution control agency staffer under law has a duty of candor to be honest and transparent, with the public. That's a PCA staffer. That's because they're balancing between the public interest and the private interest. Here, we have someone who is going to write a permit. I asked to have them have the duty of candor, and the chamber said no. They did not have the duty, as the PCA does, to be honest or transparent. So I think given that, now the public is in a double bind because this thing is only partially erroneous, and they don't know whether this has been an honest and transparent process. So we're putting the public at a lot of jeopardy. Normally I don't speak on amendments to put a bill in the shape that the author wants it, but in this case we are in a committee that is a financial committee and not a policy committee, and this seems wrong to me.
Thank you, Representative Wagenius. Representative Rukavina.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, you know, Representative Wagenius and Fabian, you know, there are a lot of good things about this bill, and there are some things that are not so good. But for those of us that have to live in a natural resource-based economy, it gets frustrating to see permits delayed and delayed. And, you know, in the case of where I come from, 4, 5, 6 years for permitting just to open up part of a plant, a mine in this case, that ran until 1984 and then shut down because of the economy. And just to reopen it, it's 4 years to even start to get the permits to reopen. You know, if you want to build Medtronic, I was up to Medtronics when I was running for, in my unsuccessful bid for governor, but I had a blast, everybody, and I'm up at Medtronics, and there's this huge, huge building that makes medical devices made out of copper, nickel, zinc, titanium, palladium, platinum, whatever. And it probably, I don't know how long it took them to get a permit. You know, anytime you want to make a giant grocery store in the cities here, a huge Walmart that sells gas that comes from ethanol. You know, it's much easier to build a building, but for the farmer that, or the plant that makes the ethanol to mix with the gas, it takes them years. You know, for the milk producer, a little family dairy farmer in the superstore that sells the milk, it takes them months or years to get a permit. And I could go on and on about, you know, whether they're selling meat or manufactured goods, how long it takes us to get a permit. And so I understand your frustration with this bill. Build a football stadium. You know, we got a proposal to build a $1 billion football stadium. $500 million is copper, nickel. I can only imagine the wiring, the plumbing, the technology going into this stadium. They'll be building the building next year if we can pass, you know, the gambling thing. So it's frustrating to us members. You can do it, we can't. You can drink the milk, but we can't get the permit to make it. You can have the heart device put in, but we can't mine copper nickel. And as far as your
you're worried about this outside expert, Representative Wagenius. That's exactly what's going on now with PolyMet. The DNR told PolyMet they had to use this firm in Colorado as an outside expert. They're writing all the permitting for copper nickel, and all that happens is PolyMet sends them a check. And once in a while, the DNR is involved in that permitting process, and they're the lead agency for permitting a copper nickel mine, and once in a while, they're not. So you're not really doing anything different than what the DNR is doing in permitting a mine right now. And finally, members, you know, this, if you're worried about this being used for mining, don't worry. Hell, you and I will be great-grandparents or in a nursing home or dead, as far as I'm concerned, before there's ever a permit made for copper nickel mining. But I'll tell you what, when all of these rules and regulations, and mostly rules that were written by some bureaucrat that we don't even know, let me digress for a minute. I'd be interested to know what the expertise is at the PCA and how much experience the person has right now writing a milk permit or a ethanol permit. A year? 6 months? 2 years? You know, but I'll get back on track. Here, I was showing Representative McNamara. Keewatin Taconite, an iron ore mine. We've been mining iron ore for 130 years. This whole sulfate issue where Frank Moe is coming down on a dog sled. By the way, raise your hands. How many people came to work on a dog sled today? How many people want to come to work on a dog sled tomorrow? Raise your hands. Phyllis, good. I'll get you one. Put that car in the junkyard. I'm getting you a dog sled. But anyhow, here's what we got to go through. Here are known companies and wastewater treatment plants in Minnesota that are way over what Keewatin Taconite is putting in for sulfates per milligram. Keewatin Taconite is at 24 milligrams per liter. Here's Granite Falls LLC, 2,430. Here's Madison Wastewater Treatment Plant, 1,000 milligrams. Minnesota Energy, wherever that is, 1,000 milligrams. Southern Minnesota Beet Sugar. They sell sugar in those big mega malls, too. 1,000 milligrams. And these people can continue to operate, but a mine that was operating for 50 years that just wants to reopen part of a plant can't move on right now because of these rules. So I understand your frustration. I'm with you. I don't know if this bill is correct yet, but you know, it's pretty easy for the people. Tori, you know what I'm talking about. All you people over there, Representative Hamilton and Gunther, you know what I'm talking about. The farther you get back in the food chain, the more hoops you got to go through to make a living. And it's gotten to the point where the kids don't know that milk comes from a cow, it comes from Byerly's. You know? The cell phone isn't full of copper nickel. It came from wherever you buy this iPhone or whatever. So I understand your frustrations. I'm as frustrated as anybody. I'm wondering why the PCA can only make mining that's 1/1,000th of what some of the other people are putting out meet rules that nobody else seems to have to meet. And I'll tell you know, I've said it facetiously, but folks, this is inside trading publicly. Buy stock in satellite outhouses, because pretty soon when I look at these rules, we're going to all be having to go to the bathroom in satellite outhouses, because almost every wastewater treatment plant, Adrian, Albert Lea, Brewster, Clara City, Fairmont, Faribault, Faustin, I could go on, Grove City, Laverne, Long Prairie, the Minneapolis Water Works, Fridley, are violating the rules. But they don't have to play by the rules. Something's wrong with the permitting system, and I'm glad somebody finally started to address it. Whether this bill is right or wrong right now, I don't know, but I'm glad to hear Mr. Kadelka say that they're still working for you, or working with you, because I'm frustrated, and your bill isn't going to do a damn thing for me, but I'm going to support it today, because, you know, I know you're a good public employee. You're a teacher. You don't hate government, but once in a while, government deserves a good kick in the gizzard, so when it takes you 3 or 4 or 6 years to get a permit, that's rear-ending Croatian. Yeah. Or worse. Anyway, that's what I got to say about it. It's frustrating.
And Representative Ruquita, I think you had your Wheaties this morning, too.
No, but I get up, you know, you make me get up at 5 o'clock, you put me in a bad mood, Madam Chair, every Monday morning.
My apologies.
We like you this
week. I'm sure you do, but I don't even like myself because this has really gotten to the point where my entire area and the livelihood we've made for 100 years is in jeopardy because of rules made by some bureaucrat that we try to change, and it seems nothing can get done.
All right, we're going to go. Representative Wagenius, I know, wants to make a comment. We have another committee coming in behind us, so if we're not able to finish this up pretty rapidly, we'll have to recess and come back later. So, Representative Wagenius.
Well, Madam Chair, I think Representative Rukavina did make a good speech about why this should go back to the Environment Committee, because he was bringing up milk permits that are done by ag. He was bringing up all sorts of permits that are done by local units of government. He was bringing up DNR permits when this is just has to do with PCA. I just don't think this amendment is ripe at this point and should be delayed until we have a good fiscal note.
All right, thank you. Any other questions on the 812 amendment? Seeing none, Representative McNamara renews his motion that we approve the 812 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay.
No.
The amendment's adopted. All right, we now have the bill in the shape in which you'd like to discuss it, and we've taken a considerable whack at the fiscal note. Representative Fabian, is there anything else you'd like to add at this point?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Just with the permitting professional, again, I need to emphasize that this is an option. This is not something that's being required. We are providing and putting another tool in the toolbox for the proposers to use. And it's not just businesses. It may be a city or a county that's got a major project going. We're trying to see if there are not people there that can help with the permitting process. And, you know, again, and the final approval of any permit has to come from the agency. Somehow or another, we're being maybe led to believe that the permit professional and the proposer get to determine that the final permit is the one is issued, and that's not what this bill is doing. Thank you.
All right, Representative Westrum.
Well, Madam Chair, not to delay, but I think I like what Representative Rukavina talked about, and I hope the department takes that to heart. It isn't Republican, it isn't Democrat, it is jobs, it is frustrated citizens in this state, and so I hope you do more than we're working on it. I hope you get there, because this is just a small another step that needs to happen in permitting in this state. And I think we even need a more comprehensive relook at what we license, what we permit, what we require. There's so many things the departments have gotten into, and the legislature's probably caused some of those, but there's agency creep movement into these all these areas, and at some point we've just got to back off the citizens and let them do what they do best. The farmer doesn't have an inherent interest in polluting their land, even though they add to their dairy barn. And so, Representative Fabian, I think this is a good bill. I hope the agency is and the governor seriously look at this and get behind this and further reform, because this frustration is out there, and milk comes from somewhere, products come from somewhere, and if you hamstring the people that are trying to do it, you take the spirit right out of them, and we need to be serious about that.
Thank you, Representative Westrum. Representative Wagenius, final words, if you might.
Well, it's one of the interesting things about this is I think we all want this to be more efficient. I do. That's not the issue here. But this bill is based on the erroneous belief that there's some recipe out there, some rules, some check boxes that you can make. But there isn't such a thing. If that was the case, this would all be done by computer. It wouldn't even need a professional. Here's the problem. there is, in say, in the seven county metro area, where we have fine particulate matter that is just right at the limit, are we going to allow a permit professional to say, oh yes, our business wants to add fine particulate matter? What's the cumulative effect on the rest of the businesses in the state? There's no, it would not be clearly erroneous to add it, but every other business, if we go over the federal level, then has to limit their pollution to accommodate this new business. That's in the metro area. In the rural or outstate Minnesota, there are aquifers that people are drawing water out of too fast. And what's happening? You're having conflicts in that area. But if some business under this bill wants to come in and say, I want a lot of water out of this aquifer, citizens really don't have much say because it's not going to be clearly erroneous. This is not, it's solving a problem, which I agree is a problem, but it is solving it in a way that hurts Minnesotans, and I am firmly opposed to this bill.
All right. Thank you, Representative Wagenius. Representative McNamara renews his motion that House File 2095, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay.
No. No.
Motion's adopted, and your bill's on the way to the General Register, and I don't believe there's any other business to become for the committee, so the committee's adjourned.
You know.